this is a good niche for you.
Good afternoon, everyone. Today is the 16th of February, and this is the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. I'm going to go ahead and call the meeting to order, seeing that we do have a quorum present. And before we get underway with some of the business of the day, Senator Hansel, do you know any of the people in the audience today?
I do, and it's my great honor to introduce, if I may, or draw attention to in the back row there. Part of the reason we have probably more people in this hearing than we would have otherwise.
I thought these people were all here to learn about the Public Utility Commission. Saying otherwise?
Well, they will if they stick around long enough, but we're hosting, our office today is hosting and working with, for the fourth year in a row, a class from Eastern Oregon University in La Grande, Oregon. They've come some distance to be here. They're learning how the legislature works and are here attending hearings and meeting with leaders, and we'll work through some bills. But their professor is Dr. Jeff Dents, who's there in the middle, the old guy. And then the students who, even though they go to Eastern Oregon in La Grande, they are really from throughout the whole state. And official, welcome again, and thank you for coming.
Well, Dr. Dents and your students, we're very, very pleased to have you here with us. And you're all lined up so nicely along the back row. Why don't you give your senator a wave? You know, we'll start that didn't go as well as anticipated. Well, you know, for the benefit of our guests, let me explain very briefly. This is a subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee. Ways and Means Committee are the people designated to review our state's budgets. And the legislature here each 2 years comes together to pass laws, but also to pass a two-year budget. And so we are the subcommittee that deals with transportation and economic development, and we will have a number of budgets before us. Transportation, you would imagine, includes the Department of Transportation. Economic development includes Business Oregon, but we have a number of other budgets as well. And today we are going to be hearing at least an introductory presentation from the Oregon Public Utilities Commission. So I'm going to go ahead and open the information hearing on House Bill 5035, and I'm going to call on Mr. Jolivet to give us a brief introduction. And while he's speaking, if those of you here to present on behalf of the agencies want to start working your way toward the podium, that would be great.
Mr. Chair and members, Gregory Jolivet with the Legislative Fiscal Office. HB 5035 relates to the budget for the Public Utilities Commission. I just note that in OLIS, under today's date, you'll find the LFO budget review along with the presentations for the PUC and the Chief Financial Office. The commission is funded almost entirely with other funds, which are generated from fees on regulated utilities. It also receives a small amount of federal funds for pipeline safety. The current service level budget of approximately $105 million supports about 126 positions. It represents a decrease of about 6.5% from the legislatively adopted budget, approved budget. And this results from anticipated reduced payments to telecommunications carriers. There are no issues in the current service level budget. The commission does have a package seeking about $400,000 to implement a new e-filing system. This is to replace their existing outdated docketing system. Today, we're going to hear from Michael Doherty, who's the PUC's chief operating officer, as well as Eric Burnett, who's the executive director for the Board of Maritime Pilots. The PUC does administrative and budget support for the Board of Maritime Pilots, so it's fairly traditional for them to give a joint presentation. And finally, we're going to hear from the CFO analyst, Robert Otero. With that, I'll turn it over.
Thank you, Mr. Jolivet. And if there's anybody here in the audience that had planned to offer testimony as part of this public hearing, there is a sign-up sheet over on the side, and we'll get to that at the end of the agency presentation. So who would like to go first?
Hello, good afternoon. Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, my name is actually Lisa Hardy. I'm the chair of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. And as noted, I'm here with Mike Doherty, who is the COO of the Oregon Public Utility Commission.
Well, welcome.
Thank you, and Robert Otero. So I've got a set of slides here that I will go through. I've got about 30 of them, and then we'll turn it over to the Board of Maritime Pilots, who will complete the rest of the presentation. And so I'll just proceed through them unless there are any questions as I go along.
Very good.
Great. Thank you. So the commission includes three commissioners. We are appointed by the governor. We are confirmed by the Oregon Senate. We are full-time and serve four-year staggered terms. In addition to me, Steve Bloom is another of the commissioners, and John Savage is the third. Commissioner Savage's term expires at the end of March, and he has not applied for reappointment. The governor has named a new nominee for his position, and if she passes through the Senate, I think we can expect a new commissioner sometime in April. The Public Utility Commission's mission statement is to ensure that Oregon utility customers have access to safe, reliable, and high-quality utility services at just and reasonable rates. The Public Utility Commission is a very old agency. We've been around since the late 1800s, one of the oldest in the state, and we are primarily economic regulators. Utility services have historically been natural monopolies, and so the Public Utility Commission provides regulatory oversight to make sure that customers are not subject to monopoly pricing.
And excuse me, for the benefit of our guests, could you give us an example or two of some of the most common utilities that we might be familiar with that you are overseeing?
Sure. On the electric side, the two biggest utilities that we regulate are Portland General Electric and PacifiCorp. And on the natural gas side, the largest natural gas utility is Northwest Natural.
Thank you.
Thank you. As part of our mission, we consider ourselves a very independent agency that deals in independent data analysis. So we have a robust and thorough analysis of utility costs and independent decision making with a fair and open process for stakeholders to participate. The next slide is the PUC's organization chart. There are the three commissioners, and you'll see three main groups or sections at the commission. One is the, and I'll go over each of these more in detail later, but the first is the utility program, and this is the analytical arm of the Public Utility Commission, everything from energy policy to energy rates and other issues that are primarily analytical in nature. We have the policy and administrative division that includes the commissioners, the commission office, HR, and a number of other things. And the third is the administrative hearings division. Unlike a lot of agencies, we have our own administrative hearings division. The ALJs act with delegated authority from the commissioners, and so that's the third arm. As far as the scope of regulation goes, investor-owned utilities primarily, so privately owned utilities, not customer-owned utilities. There are, on the electric side, there are three private electric utilities we regulate: Portland General Electric, PacifiCorp, and Idaho Power. On the natural gas side, there are three that we regulate: Northwest Natural, Avista, and Cascade Natural Gas. We also regulate about 370 telecommunications companies. Now, the scope of the utilities, the Public Utility Commission's regulatory authority over telecommunications companies, of course, has shrunk over time since the late 90s. We primarily regulate landlines now, which is, of course, a shrinking base of telecom users, but still significant and important to many people. And we also regulate about 80 small water utilities, and the largest of those is about 12,000 customers, and the smallest is four. So overall, we've got about 3 million customers that that we provide regulatory oversight for. The total revenue collected by the investor-owned utility subject to the commission's jurisdiction is almost $5 billion a year. The electric utilities have the ability to ask for rate increases at their discretion, and we see those frequently. We saw a couple in 2014, three in 2015, and two in 2016. The electric utilities under our jurisdiction account for 66% of the electricity sold in the state, and almost three-quarters of the electric customers in Oregon. So the rest of the electric service in the state is provided by customer-owned utilities, cooperatives, municipalities, public utility districts. As far as natural gas utilities go, those are all regulated by the Public Utility Commission. There are no municipal or customer-owned natural gas utilities. Those are 100%. We regulate 100% of the natural gas distribution companies in the state. Key responsibilities. We set utility rates for homes and businesses to ensure rates are just and reasonable. Rates are based on the cost of actually serving a customer. We allow utilities to recover the prudent costs of their investment to serve customers. And if those companies manage their company efficiently and well, they have an opportunity to earn a return on their investment. We set and enforce price and service rules to protect customers, ensure that private energy utility companies meet customer needs at combined lowest cost and risk. This is known as integrated resource planning. Every 2 years, the energy companies within our purview are required to submit integrated resource plans that look out on a 20-year time horizon and have embedded in them a 5-year action plan for making sure that they acquire the least cost, least risk resources to meet Oregon customer needs. We review and approve a wide variety of utility transactions, including mergers, but also property transfers or leases or anything that may affect utility customers. And we also set and enforce service quality standards. We have a very active and very excellent customer services section that works to resolve customer complaints about their utilities. We have about 1,200 customer contacts per month that are handled through that group. We manage a $28 million per year program to provide affordable phones in high-cost areas. Some of those funds are now being used to build out new infrastructure in high-cost areas. We set and enforce rules for fair competition in energy and telecommunications. And in one area that is, I guess, our area of broadest jurisdiction is the safety jurisdiction, we ensure that pipeline, power lines, transformer stations, and energy facilities operate safely. And we have, again, a very excellent safety section, and the Commission's authority in the safety area expands beyond the privately owned utilities. And, in fact, we have duties for safety issues also for the customer-owned utilities, the 19 cooperatives, 12 municipalities, and the 6 public utility districts in the state. We administer the Residential Service Protection Fund, and that is a fund that I will discuss a little bit more later, but it funds a constellation of programs that, I guess, ensure that Oregonians have access to communications equipment. We ensure that the Energy Trust of Oregon acquires cost-effective energy efficiency on behalf of PacifiCorp, PGE, Northwest Natural, Avista, and Cascade, again, primarily through a competitive process to ensure that that is a cost-effective process. We oversee regulated energy providers concerning seismic and cybersecurity preparedness. We meet with the investor-owned utilities regularly on cybersecurity and seismic issues. And I'm a member of the Governor's Disaster Recovery Cabinet.
Before you get into the budget overview, I just want to back up for a sec. You mentioned that you receive about 1,200 complaints each month.
They're not all complaints.
Well,
they're
contacts.
Yeah.
Contacts. How many people do you have handling those 1,200 contacts?
Chair Gomberg, I'm Michael Daugherty. We have about 13 people, including the manager, that handle those contacts. They're all. We have 3 senior compliance specialists, and we have 9 public service representatives that handle it. And the volumes of calls go up and down. I think the last week they were consumed with calls. In a 4-day period, we had almost 500 calls based on high energy prices that happened in January.
I'm not surprised. All right, thank you. Please continue.
I'll note as well, Chair Gomberg and members of the committee on that issue, we sometimes get calls that are not related to regulated utilities. So, for example, there are some telecom or cable providers that we don't regulate, but our group does the best they can to assist customers, even with things that aren't within our jurisdiction. So try to provide help on that regard as well. Okay, moving to the budget. On the left hand, you'll see the limited funds. On the right hand side, the non-limited funds. The limited funds are divided between the administrative policy and administrative division, utility division, and the RSPF fund, with a little bit for the Board of Maritime Pilots. The Board of Maritime Pilots is actually an independent agency. They are with us for administrative purposes only, and so they'll have a separate section of this presentation. I will note that as has been noted before, the agency receives no general or lottery funds. We are funded primarily through a per-month charge on regulated natural gas, electric, telecommunication, and water utility bills. And so that charge is approximately 20 cents per bill. And so that's the main funding we've got there. For the non-limited funds, the $56 million on the right side, this is the from the Oregon Universal Service Fund. These revenues are mandated by statute. Again, this is funds that are collected from all retail telecommunication providers for service in Oregon. And these go to either pay down the high cost telecommunication services or to build out services in high cost areas. Our budget overview, we just wanted to give a view here of the 2013 to 2015 legislatively adopted budget, the 2015 to 2017, and the 2017 to 2019 governor's recommended budget. We've got an overall decrease that is primarily due to fewer funds coming into the Oregon Universal Service Fund due to fewer lines. The next slide is budget revenues. On the limited funds, again, you can see in the orange there, utility fees fund the majority of our operations. There's some through the RSPF funds as well, and a small slice of federal funds. Again, the non-limited funds are entirely a pass-through of funds through the OUSF. As far as budget drivers are concerned, personnel and other personnel expenses are consistently a major driver of the Public Utility Commission's operations. There's a tight labor market and competition for analysts for the Public Utility Commission. We do some fairly technical analysis on some fairly complex issues, and so a lot of the employees at the commission are engineers, lawyers, economists, accountants, and so we are constantly competing for labor in that regard. The next three items, OTRS payments, OTAP payments, and TDAP payments, these are all programs that assist Oregonians with access to communications services, and I'll discuss them more, but OTRS is the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service. It allows Oregonians with hearing or speech disability to place and receive phone calls with the assistance of a relay operator. The OTAP program helps low-income customers afford telephone service. And TDAP is the Telecommunications Device Access Program, and that allows Oregonians access to adaptive equipment that allows them to communicate. So those are those items. Attorney General expenses are about 6% of the budget. Again, we have some very complex rate cases and other investigations that frequently require Attorney General assistance. So we have one commission counsel and four attorneys that are assigned to the PUC. Rent is approximately 4% of the budget, and other services and supplies are about 9%. Budget risks. The first one we know is decreasing landlines equals decreasing revenue. We are seeing a revenue decrease of about 1.5% per year for landlines. Obviously, people are migrating to cellular or VoIP services instead, so I think we can expect that decline to continue. Lower natural gas prices equals smaller growth in natural gas revenue. Lower natural gas prices have been great for customers. They're smaller bills, but obviously, if we put an assessment on the bills, then the lower that revenue, the lower the revenue we receive as well. And also flat growth in electric revenue. Although the Oregon population has been growing, we have a number of policies in Oregon, including energy conservation, investment in distributed generation, lower natural gas prices, all of which help keep the growth in electric demand fairly flat. We engage in a number of cost containment issues. We've seen a reduction in supervisory personnel and administrative personnel. We engage in vacancy savings and administrative savings. We've deferred a number of IT purchases to capture savings. Commission employees have reduced their travel. And we also have some data sharing agreements with the Department of Revenue and DHS that allow us to implement some of our programs without having to do a build out of a separate system, and that captures some cost savings as well. So I'm going to briefly discuss the programs, the groups within the commission. The utility program is the biggest one, and again, this is the technical and analytical arm of the Public Utility Commission, and they provide financial accounting, engineering, and economics-oriented analysis for us. We have folks in energy, including resources and planning, rates, finance, and audit. We've got telecom and water group that handles service quality, rates, and water issues, competitive issues, and handle universal service issues. We have a safety group that handles utility safety, reliability, and security. And we also have policy and support staff. Another function of the utility program is to oversee the Energy Trust of Oregon to ensure that the ETO generates effective results. The ETO is tasked with conservation savings and renewable resource development. And so we have stringent oversight of the ETO, including yearly performance measures, a grant agreement that describes the ETO's obligations. We require quarterly and annual reporting to the PUC. We have regular management coordination meetings between the ETO and the PUC. We review yearly budget and the ETO's yearly budget and action plan. And we require third-party management audits every 5 years and financial statement audits every year. I've mentioned the Residential Service Protection Fund a couple of times, and I want to talk about that a little bit more. The RSPF supports the state's policy that all Oregonians have access to adequate and affordable telephone service. It consists of four programs, and we have 8 full-time employees. It's the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program, or OTAP, the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service, or OTRS, the Telecommunication Devices Access Program, or TDAP, and Emergency Medical Certificates Program. These are funded with a surcharge that has decreased over the past 5 years from 12 cents to 7 cents. We have a statutory maximum on that charge of 35 cents, so we are well under that cap. Again, the OTAP reduces monthly landline charges for low-income Oregonians, and that serves approximately 62,500 Oregonians. The TDAP program loans adaptive telecommunications equipment at no cost to eligible Oregonians, and that serves approximately 6,550 Oregonians. The OTRS program allows a person with a hearing or speech disability to place and receive phone calls through text telephone devices, and so they can communicate with folks who use standard telephone equipment. This service operates 24 hours a day and handles almost 300,000 calls annually.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt again.
Yes.
The relay service for hearing impaired Oregonians, has that number been changing with the advent of text telephones and personal devices? What are the trends there?
So I'll let Mike speak in a moment to if he actually has data or numbers. I could get back to you on that. I don't have that with me right now, but we do have see a trend. We have, for example, the TDAP program has recently expanded to use iPads that are loaded with additional equipment that allow people to communicate. So we are running some pilots on that and have seen that to be a very effective expansion of the TDAP program. So you're correct that I think we are seeing more availability of widely available and affordable devices that allow people to communicate more easily. We do see ongoing need for the OTRS program. I don't know, Mike, if you have numbers on that or if that's something we could get back to Chair Gumberg on.
Chair Gumberg, I'm going to have to get back to you on exact numbers. I know this decrease, and we've been able to negotiate a very decreased contract with Sprint, who's our provider right now on that. But Chair Hardy is right. We're seeing a lot of movement on our TDAP program where we have the iPads. And we actually are using iPads. We had a pilot, now we're using it as a program. And it's very cost effective. Some of the equipment we were using, especially the speech generating device, might be as much as $5,000, $7,000. We are able to get an iPad that's loaded, depending on who's using it, for about $1,000. And there's a lot of protection on the iPad. We have a lot of controls on the iPad. But it's been we're only one of two states that are doing that right now. I think there might be a third that's going to initiate it. And it means a lot, because you're right. There's Skype, there's FaceTime, there's all these other ways to communicate that wasn't around, 15 years ago. So we're probably going to see those numbers go down, but I don't have the exact numbers with me.
And at the same time, I would imagine that just because the numbers are going down, the relay operators are still needed on site 24/7, even if there's been a substantial decrease in the number of calls. So, all right, I'll look forward to a little more information. Don't spend a lot of time, but a little more information would be appreciated.
Thank you. So the last bullet on that slide is for the Emergency Medical Certificates Program, and this allows customers who are under a doctor's care the option of a more lenient plan to pay their bills. So if you get sick and you have trouble paying your electric bills, this will allow us to help you work with the utilities to ensure that your service is not disconnected. So there are a couple pieces of pending legislation from us on the RSPF. One is Senate Bill 84, the Landline Wireless Service Subscribers RSPF Surcharge. That's a mouthful. This would amend statute establishing PUC authority to apply the RSPF surcharge to customers of interconnected VoIP service with access to the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service. Currently, if you are a VoIP provider and you have access to the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Service, you do not pay into this fund. Other types of telecommunications providers do. And so this would sort of level that playing field and ensure that if you are a telecommunications provider that provides this service, that you pay into the fund. The Oregon Telecommunications Association supports this bill. We don't know of any opposition. This would, we think, increase 2017 to 2019 revenue by about $243,000. It recently passed out of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee with a 5-0 vote, with subsequent referral to the Ways and Means. Another is Senate Bill 85. Again, this is a bill that has no known opposition and I think a lot of support. The TDAP program currently has an advisory committee that is made up of 12 members. And this would amend the statute that establishes that committee to shrink the size of that to 7. There has been some difficulty keeping that committee membership full and ensuring that there's a quorum for votes. So by reducing the number of members on this advisory committee, we think it will allow the committee to more consistently achieve a quorum.
So, Senator Hansel.
Yes.
Who will be eliminated?
Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, the representation will stay the same. There will still be members of different communities. It will be just less members. Right now, we do, as Chair Hardy said, we have troubles trying to recruit, trying to retain. So we basically kept the percentage of the membership, but lowered the membership, so no one's left out.
Follow up.
Please.
Well, as I read that slide, you've got four that have one representative. So if you make it less, you eliminate.
Well, on Chair Gomberg, Senator Hansel, what you're seeing on the slide is actually the makeup of the 7, not the 12 that's current. So
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that would be the makeup.
This
is what's being proposed.
My mistake. Thanks for that clarification.
Yeah.
So again, there's no known opposition to this bill, and it passed out of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee with a 5-0 vote, with a subsequent referral to the Senate floor. The Administrative Hearings Division of the Commission is an independent division that reports directly to the commissioners. There are 10 full-time employees in this division. As I noted earlier, the PUC has its own administrative law judges. This is due to the fact that utility regulation is somewhat unique and complex, and so the PUC is exempt from use of the ALJs and the administrative hearings, the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is the central pool of ALJs that often serves state agencies. And the cases handled by AHD range from highly complex rate cases and investigations to more straightforward consumer complaints. There is one piece of legislation pending related to the Administrative Hearings Division. This is a housekeeping measure. The legislature at one point in time moved the appeal of Oregon Commission orders from automatic appeal to the Circuit Court up to the Court of Appeals. There was some language in the statute that inadvertently, there are actually different kinds of orders that we issue. Some of those should have gone to the Court of Appeals, those in contested cases, and others should not because there's no record for those non-contested case orders. And so this just cleans up the language of the statute of ORS 756-610 to make sure that the correct orders from the Commission go to the Court of Appeals versus the Circuit Court. This measure passed out of the Senate Business and Transportation Committee with a 5-0 vote, with subsequent referral to Judiciary. There is one policy option package that was noted at the beginning of the meeting that we are seeking, and it is about $400,000 to update our e-filing and e-discovery system. The Commission has a custom-built legacy docketing system that was built in 1998 using Visual Basic 6, which is no longer supported. So it's an antiquated and sort of outdated, still functional, but definitely difficult to update program. And we deal with most of our constituents through the internet. Through our cases are handled through electronic filing, electronic discovery, they are sort of cobbled together in different pieces. We use a third-party service for e-discovery. So this policy option package would allow us to have a vendor customize and configure and create a system that integrates all of these and updates them so that we can focus on customer needs and that we have some sustainability with the system going forward. Again, we think the cost will be approximately $400,000. This would be supported by fees paid by the utility companies, so there would be no general funds used for this particular policy option package. The third major division of the Commission is the Policy and Administration Division. There are about 39.5 FTEs under the key policy and administrative section, which is comprised of the commissioners, commission services, and the commission offices, consumer services, human resources, business services, and IT. We also have 8 full-time employees for the RSPF, and there are 2 full-time employees for the Board of Maritime Pilots, which technically falls under this group. Performance measures. The PUC has 16 key performance measures, and they include the first one is to maintain electricity rates that are lower than the national average, acquire low-cost energy conservation effectively and efficiently, prevent personal injury to electricity and natural gas customers and industry workers, maintain a healthy level of competition in the telecommunications and electricity industries, promote utility pricing that encourages the efficient use of water and energy, investigate customer complaints and issue complaint orders in a timely fashion, maintain a high level of agency customer service, successfully inform target populations about special telecommunications programs, maintain effective ETO performance.
Good question.
Yes, please.
Thank you. I wonder if you could actually just give us a quick summary of how we're performing in those areas.
Sure. In 2016, we met 75% of those. I have a list of the ones that we failed to meet, and they were, let me see if I can pull those up here. So the key performance measures that are in yellow here, so the 15%, one of them is related to evidentiary records. We try to process consumer complaint orders within 30 days of the close of an evidentiary record. So if you're a customer, you come in and you have a hearing. Once the record of evidence is closed, we try to have an order for you within 30 days. We achieved 90% of the 100% target due just to one case that didn't reach that. It took 50 days instead of 30. The other is complaint investigation. We try to close complaint investigations within 50 days. We achieved 69% compared to a 75% target for that. So it just kind of goes up and down. Sometimes we're better and sometimes we're slightly lower, but we are aiming for 75% target of 50 days or less, and we hit 69. We're working to improve that. Customer service, another in the yellow, percent of customers rating their satisfaction with the agency's customer service as good or excellent. So we have a sort of a list of measures here. Availability of information, we have a goal of 80%, and we reached 72, still on that one. Overall support, we have a goal of 84%, good or excellent, and our actual was 80. Accuracy, 84% versus 78%. Expertise, 83 versus 80, and timeliness, 86 versus 85. So we're doing really well, just slightly in the yellow on some of those. And on the red, one is best practices for the Board of Maritime Pilots. I think they're, I don't have information on that one. I'll leave that one to the Board of Maritime Pilots. But the last one that's in red actually relates to the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. One element of eligibility for the OTAP, which is for low-income customers, is participation in SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. So we try to target, I think, 26% of customers who receive those benefits. We try to ensure they have access to the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program. And we received only 16%. But some of the reasons for that are simply we're finding competition. So we're able to provide some assistance, but folks are going out there and getting their own fairly cheap access to telephones or pay-as-you-go phones or that sort of thing. So I think we may need to look at this measure in light of new technology changes to see whether that benchmark is going to be the correct one in the future.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Reardon, this looks like a good time to interrupt the flow of things. So thank you for being here today. There's a lot more to the PSC than I realized. And I think that might have to do with performance measures, but could you define for me a docket and then talk about things, the success in completing the dockets and how rapidly those occur?
Chair Gallimore, members of the committee, that can vary widely with us. It can be something as complex as a utility rate case. Once that is filed, a request for a rate increase from a utility can be filed. And we need to statutorily finish that within 9 months of the filing. And it can take that all of that 9 months. Sometimes we even have to extend that by a few months, which the statute allows to finish that. But it's a review of all of the utilities, books, and operations, and is a very complex endeavor. Sometimes it can be something as a customer complaint that can be resolved very, very, very quickly. So I would say that our dockets range from complex rate cases. Sometimes we need to do staff investigations into issues. Mm-hmm. Depending on those issues, again, they can resolve themselves very quickly. If it's a limited issue that staff is investigating, we'll open a docket number, allow people to participate, set up a schedule for people to participate in that. If it's a fairly narrowly focused investigation, those can wrap up within months. Sometimes, depending on what they are, they can last for months or a year or even longer, because sometimes those get phased. We'll address new policy issues in phase one, then we'll go to phase two. So I guess I would say that it sort of depends on the issue.
Okay. Right. Thank you. Please.
So as I think most folks are aware, the energy industry is changing very rapidly, and so we want to address some environmental factors that we face at the Commission. One is Oregon's population growth. We expect Oregon's population to grow. This translates into greater demand for utility services. Although the nature of the utility services that customers are seeking is changing. Advances in new types of telecommunications services and technology advances are changing both energy and telecommunications markets. Particularly complex is for us is some of the changes to the energy industry. There's new technology, distributed generation, including rooftop solar, microturbines, fuel cells, microgrids. All these things are increasing the complexity of utility operations and of customer expectations about what their energy should look like and where it should come from. And these changes are very new to the industry, and they're raising some fundamental issues about some longstanding regulatory concepts that are going to require some policy adaptation by the Commission. Slower regional economic recovery is creating increased demand for utility service assistance program. You know, this is an issue that we always see, and I don't think we see it abating, particularly in rural areas, that folks sometimes need assistance with their electric bills. Emerging, changing, and uncertain federal laws and rules concerning greenhouse gas emissions, energy development, and energy consumption, as well as tax incentives, all of these things have really great impacts on utility operations and planning. Heightened concerns about the risks posed by cyber attacks and major earthquakes on utility facilities. The utilities we regulate are spending larger and larger amounts of their time trying to address these issues and stay ahead of them. And on the telecom side, we continue to see a decrease in telephone landline use due to uptake of other types of technology like cellular telephones, voice over internet protocol, and internet usage such as Skype. In this context, utilities are finding the need to invest in capital projects to meet growing demand from customers for changes in technology and also to meet new federal and state mandates. We see increased energy utility customer demands concerning options for green tariffs that utilize greater selections and availability of renewable power. We have customers that say we don't want just any generic electric service. Folks, I think you see companies like, you know, Apple and Google and an increasing number of customers looking for a specific kind of energy. They want renewable energy. And we also see changes to federal laws and rules promoting development of broadband, as well as fundamental changes to universal service funding. So we are striving to adapt policy-wise to make sure that we understand all these changes and stay on top of them. In terms of major changes to the agency, we transfer the Consumer Services Division back into the Policy Administration Division from the Utility Program in 2016. This was just for administrative control reasons. As I'm sure folks are aware, House Bill 4131 reduced supervisory personnel. In response to House Bill 4131, we reduced supervisory personnel from 25 to 14. Our utility program went from 15 supervisors to 7 supervisors. The Policy Administration Division went from 8 to 5. The administrative hearings just has 1 supervisor, so that stayed the same. But overall, we moved from a span of control of 1 to 4 to 1 to 8. And this meets the 2016 goal of 1 to 8. I will note that we've done this successfully, and I think we're managing it well, but it does make it more difficult to hire administrators as a result of the elimination of subordinate managers in the utility program. We've got a lot of responsibilities for our managers and have had some difficulty recently on some management positions, but we're continuing to work through those issues. Any questions? I believe I'm at the end of my part of the presentation. I'm ready to hand it on to the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots unless there are additional questions.
We're going to let you off the hook in just a moment, but I wanted to back up to the seismic preparation that you're involved in. Could you give me 30 seconds on what kind of conversations you're having there?
Well, with the utilities?
Yes, please.
Yes. So we are of course working with the Governor's Office of Emergency Management in terms of what the Oregon Public Utility Commission's responsibilities are in that regard, and they're with Energy and Communications. So we are taking those roles, and we are interfacing with the utilities first to know what are they doing in terms of their planning. We're monitoring it. We're making them report on those sorts of things. And then we are making sure that we are in a position to work with them as sort of an interface with the Office of Emergency Services, sorry, the OEM, in order to, if there's a seismic event, that we are all prepared to handle that. So we two different things. One, oversight of the electric utilities to make sure we know what they're doing in that regard, and they give us regular updates. And we make sure that they make some prudent investments in that regard and are planning correctly for, I guess what I would say, are the most sensitive and difficult areas of their operations that they need to protect. And then making sure that we serve sort of an oversight and communications role with the overall state planning process.
Very good. Other questions, colleagues? Yes, Representative Reardon.
Oh, I don't know if I should ask this or not, but I'm new to the committee, so I get to ask anything, right? So, if I understand it correctly, the bulk of your funds come from the utilities that you regulate. Has that ever come up as a potential conflict or an issue in the... would you recommend any changes?
Chair Gomberg, members of the committee, I don't know that it has been a controversial issue. I think, for the most part, I think folks have supported it. I haven't heard any suggestion that we should move to general fund or some other type of funding, okay. If that answers your question.
That's one. I didn't expect any. I mean, you have a stellar reputation, so I just...
I think I'm trying to think of what kind of conflict you might have. I think it's historically been a funding mechanism for a while. And
yeah. Representative Meek.
Chair Gomberg, thank you. Just a quick question. As you see, we're talking about technological changes. What are your projections as more electric vehicles come online and our changes occur? Do you see that creating a bigger strain on the electric grid?
Chair Gomberg, Representative Meek, we, as you know, Senate Bill 1547, which was passed last session, did create requirements around utility planning for electric vehicles, and we currently have an ongoing rulemaking to determine that essentially we are requiring the utilities go and analyze precisely that issue, what kind of investments would be effective, how inefficient for customers, how that would affect their utility planning process. And so we are actively engaged in working with the utilities and stakeholders to figure out precisely that question.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Very good. Yes, Representative Reardon.
Well, I'm glad you asked. A follow-up on that question. So does that planning, is there planning that also takes place for the co-ops and the other privately owned? They cover a vast part of the state geographically.
Chair Gomberg, Representative Reardon, we don't actually oversee the customer-owned utilities processes in this regard.
Right.
This is strictly for the investor-owned utilities that we regulate. So again, that's about covers about three-quarters of the customers in the state. I'm afraid I don't have the depth of knowledge to speak to how the consumer-owned utilities are handling that right now.
So is it fair to say that a vast part of the state is not benefiting from 1547, the planning and so forth that's going on as a result of that? I'm interested in promoting EVs across the state, obviously, so I think a yes or no answer might be okay.
Chairman Gomberg, Representative Reardon, I'm not sure that's true. There's an organization in here called Drive Oregon that is a statewide that is providing sort of statewide oversight and assistance in this regard for EV planning. So we're sort of doing what I would call a very public utility commission sort of look at this, which is how can specifically the utility within our purview make efficient, effective investments in sort of accelerating EVs and what's the effect of that on customers? But there are some broader looks that are happening that are outside our sort of more narrow purview.
Okay. You're not the only game in town.
Correct.
All right. Thank you.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for your presentation. Let's continue with Mr. Burnett.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you very much, Representative Gomberg, members of the committee. My name is Eric Burnett. I'm executive director of the Oregon Board of Maritime Pilots, and we are a state agency founded in 1846, predating statehood by a bit. We have three basic tasks. First is to ensure safe pilotage in the state, safe ship pilotage in the state. Second is to provide licensing and licensing oversight for about 65 pilots, give or take a few, depending on retirements. That's our typical load. And third is to administer the tariffs, the pilotage tariffs in the four pilotage grounds spread among three pilotage groups in the state. And so those would be Coos Bay, Yaquina Bay as one group, Columbia River Bar, open ocean to the Megler Bridge on the Columbia River, and then the Columbia River pilots from the Megler Bridge all the way up to the navigable headwaters of the Columbia. And that is all done under the umbrella of the administrative umbrella, the PUC. The overlap that we have there is actually a little bit more significant than is immediately apparent. We are safety focused in many respects, as a PUC is with pipelines and transmission, and also we administer a tariff. And so the our home under the PUC umbrella is a logical one. For those of you not familiar with the job of a maritime pilot, it is simply to provide local expertise to bring ships in and through a complex river system. And the analogy is not perfect, but it serves relatively well. A ship pilot deals in an environment that is completely different from harbor to harbor to harbor, as opposed to an airline pilot who, disregarding the mountains around the airport, is pretty much going to be looking at the same sort of runway pretty much everywhere. And that's the reason that that marine pilots exist. You really do need somebody who has expertise, for instance, in the case of the Columbia River pilots, to move a vessel 104 miles up the river from Astoria. It's a complex environment to work in. Our current budget under the PUC is $797,000. The proposed 17-19 budget is $802,000. It's a change of roughly 0.7%. It's a very small increase. The numbers that you see provided on this slide are current actuals. The lion's share of our budget expenditures go to personnel and personnel-related expenses. Attorney general fees are significant. I'll talk about them later. They're about 11%. Professional services are about 6% at this point. Rent is a little over 3%. And the other services are about 12%. The budget risks that we face are interesting. We have a $35,000 $1,000 expenditure this time for maritime incidents and investigations. Incident expenses for us are really defined by the category of incident, the seriousness of an incident. If the incident is small, under $150,000 in damage to the ship, does not involve intoxication on the part of a pilot, or does not involve a spill of oil of over 50 gallons, it's considered a Category 2 incident. A Category 1 incident is the more serious one, and for that one, it's at the option of the chair of the board to hire an outside incident investigator. And so in this past year, we've had two such incidents, and that total at this point has run to $35,000. We have two more incidents that are still relatively early in the investigation phase, but those expenditures are quite unpredictable. They just depend on what happens to be coming at us in any given year. We obviously can't predict those. The increased risk that we see from attorney fees is due to several things. We are in the process of working through a proposed tariff review program. And this is something that is fairly new for us, and we're working hand in hand with the PUC to help define that program, certainly taking advantage of their expertise. We have a medical oversight program that is also, I would say at this point, about 70% through to completion. It's going to involve some additional expenses. In essence, what it will do is bring our mariners, our pilots, licenses up for Coast Guard medical review twice as often as they currently are now. It is just something that the board feels will add to the safety of pilotage in the state and will increase the amount of oversight. There were some problems in the Costco Busan incident in San Francisco where the ship collided with the bridge, and it was really that incident that caused the board to start to think its way through this particular set of problems. We're also updating our ethics and transparency processes. We've been working with the DOJ on that particular set of issues as well. All of these combined have added somewhat to our to our legal bills. As far as Columbia River traffic and Coos Bay traffic are concerned, I should also add Willamette River traffic as well, because Willamette is part of the Columbia River pilot's pilotage grant. We are involved in several different initiatives right now. One of them is in responding to the Washington Department of Ecology's investigation of oil transport practices on the Columbia. That has caused a little bit of staffed load time. Coos Bay traffic, we're anticipating potentially an LNG terminal there, and with it the requirement to bring in additional pilots and probably do a fairly significant revamp of the training the training and licensing program there as well. The environmental factors that we're dealing with at this point are federal and quite often international as well. All fossil fuel transport, be it LNG or domestic crude, coal, is under increased scrutiny. And this is something that everybody in our industry is very, very much aware of, and it's something the Board of Maritime Pilots is paying close attention to as well. In addition, we are benefiting from some real improvements in navigation technology at this point, and frankly, the waterways of this state and of the nation are much safer because of these new technologies that are coming along, but we have to incorporate them into our licensing and training as well. Additionally, I mentioned medical standards before. One of the other things that we're working on, have worked on, and have made some real progress in is better fatigue reporting and oversight. So we're starting to see quarterly fatigue numbers being reported by our pilots. Each pilotage ground is unique. The Columbia River Bar has a different set of fatigue issues than would the Columbia River, for instance. We are receiving on a quarterly basis the fatigue performance from all of our pilot groups, tracking that, pushing that back out to our board. And I've got to say, being two reporting cycles in, the results that I'm seeing are excellent. They're very good. I did mention Coos Bay and Yaquina Bay in terms of LNG. That is going to be a major point of discussion for us. The final one that I would like to point out is an interesting one. There has been an international maritime organization requirement to shift to ultra-low sulfur fuels. And if any of you happen to have had any past experience with bunker fuel, this was until very recently the fuel of choice in the marine industry. Bunker fuel is basically asphalt without the sand and gravel. It doesn't even flow as a liquid until you heat it up to about 140 degrees. But you can run it through a diesel engine. Big marine diesels are designed for it. The problem is it has an enormous amount of sulfur, and it produces quite a bit of soot. At this point, we're now requiring nationally and internationally vessels within 200 miles of shore to use fuel that contains only 0.1% sulfur. This is much more than a tenfold decrease in past levels. Much less soot, it's a much cleaner fuel. The problem is it's a very liquid fuel. It doesn't lubricate the sides of the cylinder walls, and we've had a number of engine failures in the river as a result of this, as the ships have gotten used to switching back and forth between a viscous and non-viscous fuel. The upside is the airshed quality is significantly improved. The downside is everybody, and this is a national problem, is having to learn how to manage these dual fuel engines. We're getting there, but it has frankly added to our investigation expenses as well. That is the end of my presentation, and I'd be happy to entertain any questions at all.
Are there questions for the witness? Representative Reardon?
Just easy one. Do they literally switch tanks on these ships? Or?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And they do. And they have to maintain segregated tankage in the vessel.
Okay.
Segregated piping system coming to the engines. And it's a process that has to be done fairly carefully.
Yeah.
Because you can heat shock the engine.
So. Okay. Well, one more.
Others? Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. I'm just curious, if you have an increased demand for pilots, are you able to recruit sufficiently and get them trained, or where do they come from?
That's an excellent question. Where they come from depends on the pilotage ground, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. We do have a good number of pilots in our waiting and reserve list. The Columbia River Bar pilots tend to recruit from blue water captains, people who have been sailing as an ocean master for two or more years, which makes sense given the pilotage ground that they work. The river pilots recruit typically from the tug and barge industry on the Columbia, which also makes sense, given that very different environment. And the Coos Bay pilots, there are only two pilots currently active. We have three licensed in Coos Bay, two active. And they tend to be recruited from the industry down there, often coming out of tug and barge. Okay. We are finding that we are seeing a potential tail off due to the fact that the Jones Act fleet, the U.S. flag fleet, is contracting so much, that there will come a time when we will probably have to do more apprentice training as opposed to trainee training. We can bring people in now with a high level of experience. We may need to do what is done elsewhere in the world and bring people in with a lower level of experience and train them up as apprentices.
Yeah, interesting.
Senator Hansel?
Mine's more curiosity because the Columbia River Bar borders much of my district. And how many river pilots do we have actually operational within Oregon? I'm assuming there's some on the Willamette and some on, of course, the Columbia. But
the way the pilotage total is divided up in the state is two at Coos Bay, Yaquina Bay, 15 to 16. We have a trainee on the Columbia River. And the remainder, 45 or so, are going to be in the Columbia. All of our Columbia River pilots are required to be competent in the entire pilotage ground from the Migler Bridge really up to the I-5 bridge. There are a number of pilots who have additional pilotage further up into the Bonneville Pool, the Dallas Pool, and the like.
One other quick thing, too, because I'm assuming that you've got the locks on both sides of the river, that you're actually in the state of Washington for part of it, state of Oregon, when you're doing the Columbia, I'm assuming that you have they can go to either state and even further up into Washington if they need to, or Idaho.
Yes, we've had a relationship with the state of Washington for many decades that gives Oregon administrative control over pilotage in the Columbia River, Columbia Willamette system.
Okay, thank you. Snake River as well?
I would want to check on that. My understanding is that our pilotage grounds do not include the Snake, so they don't go up to Lewiston, but they do go up to the navigable headwaters of the Columbia, which are not terribly far above the confluence with the with a Snake, but that's a good question. I don't believe they do include the Idaho waters.
Okay. Other questions?
Yeah, Mr. Co-Chair. I spoke to the Pilots Association one time and chastised them for being too accurate. There's a rail bridge across between Oregon and Washington that is one of the oldest and most congested bridges, and also the pilots have to make a big S when they go under the interstate bridge, and then a half mile downriver, they have to go through this rail bridge. And the rail bridge really needs to be replaced. The problem is federal money to replace bridges is under the Truman-Hobbs Act, and they require that some incident or accident has occurred. So if one of our pilots had bumped that bridge a little, with their barge, then we could get federal money to replace it. But they're too good at their job.
So you were encouraging them to take the bridge out?
No, not take it out. Just bump it a little bit.
Oh, okay.
You're looking for a reportable incident, sir?
Okay. Are there other questions? All right. If not, thank you so much. Mr. Otero, you've been waiting patiently. What have you got to tell us about all these good folks?
Thank you, Representative Gomberg. For the record, my name is Robert Otero, and I'm an analyst with the Chief Financial Office. I'm going to go ahead and switch positions here and then get my presentation going.
Very good. Welcome back.
Okay. Co-Chair Gomberg and members of the committee. Once again, the presentation you're about to see is a standard presentation from the Chief Financial Office to orient the committee on changes in the governor's budget. This presentation is for PUC, and it encompasses the Board of Maritime Pilots also. The agency's emerging issues are mainly responding to changes in technology and communications. As population grows, the need for utility regulation also increases. Changes in energy policy also affects the agency. For example, 2016 session, I believe Senate Bill 1547 changed some oversight. So the governor's budget maintains current service level and also invests in systems to create efficiencies, which I'll talk about further, and then expands the Oregon telecommunications relay service surcharge of 7 cents to include a voice over internet protocol. This chart is the expenditures for the agencies. As you can see, the main decrease is from the non-limited other funds, which is a pass-through for the agency for the Oregon Universal. I'm gonna get this right. OUSF fund, Oregon Universal Fund. But if you look down in the green, that really shows you the expenditures for the agency. And you could see from the legislative adopted in 15-17 to the governor's budget in 17-19, there's minimal growth. So the agency has really not grown very much and put off expenses. This chart shows expenditure by category. As you can see, 55% of the budget is for the OUSF fund. And then it breaks it down to about 63% personal services if you actually go to the other funds only. And then 36% services and supplies. Okay. This is the revenue history for the 2017-19 governor's budget. As you can see on the previous slide for expenditures, the other funds expenditures decreased, the non-limited other funds decreased, and as the budget coincides with that, with the revenues. The two investments for the agency are the Residential Service Protection Fund, which expands a surcharge of 7 cents, and that's policy package 102, I believe. And the other package is the utility e-filing and e-discovery system for $400,000 and other funds. Finally, the governor's budget makes minor technical adjustments for professional services, and then statewide adjustments for DAS price list and state government service charges, as well as adjustment for attorney general rates, which reduced some expenditures for the agency. Other than that, that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Any questions? All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have two people signed up to testify in support of this this measure. I have Ms. Thompson and Mr. Bauer. If you'd like to come on up. And is there anyone else in the audience today who wanted to testify?
Is there anybody else in the audience?
Welcome.
Thank you. Janice Thompson with the Citizens Utility Board, a residential kind of repair advocate that does do analysis and other work, including interactions with the PUC. So here is a part of the budget. A few, I'll be very brief. The PUC folks have a lot of work, and they are working hard. Their work is high quality, and the staff analysis is valuable and beneficial to utility customers. The new docket system will definitely be helpful. The Residential Service Protection Fund and related efforts are particularly valuable to consumers. So to conclude, the requested budget is prudent and needed. So very short and succinct.
Well, thank you for both. Any questions? Mr. Bauer.
Thank you, Chair Gomberg. Members of the committee, I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. Just brief background, we are regulated by the Public Utility Commission. We're a natural gas local distribution company, which means we aren't involved in the production or transmission of natural gas. So unlike on the electric side, where they actually may generate and own the transmission systems, we buy from producers, pay interstate transmission companies to transmit it to us, and then we distribute it within our system. Our system ranges from the Willamette Valley, we're down the coast in certain populated areas, we go as far as east as the Dalles. So to us, it's very important for the Public Utility Commission and their operations to make sure that they have adequate resources and they have the flexibility to keep up with the changing demands that are happening in our industry, as well as the electric and other utilities. We're faced with a lot of external forces on our product in terms of where we acquire it from, how we deliver it. And so to us, it's very important that the commission have resources necessary to deal with those issues. In addition, we also think it's important that they have qualified staff. The cases before the commission are very technical, and they can become fairly long and drawn out. And to us, it's important that they have the staff that's qualified, and they also are able to retain that staff so that we don't go in for a rate case or a discussion every year. They can be 2, 4, 6, maybe as long as 8 years out. And so still having staff that have knowledge and expertise in the natural gas area is important to us. And then finally, on the safety side, we work closely with the Public Utility Commission. They have been a very good regulator and partner. I'll call it a partner because a number of years ago we approached the commission and said we have a lot of bare steel and cast iron pipe in our system, and we think we should remove that, all of those. We're one of only probably two utilities in the country that have completely removed those from our system. And we were able to do that because the Public Utility Commission had the foresight to say, yes, those types of infrastructure need to be removed. And so that has both made our system, we think, much safer, as well as tightened the system so we don't have leaks, which add to climate issues and other things. So I just want to say that we think it's important that, again, that the commission have the resources necessary to do their job. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bauer. Any questions? Sir? All right. Well, very good. Mr. Jolivet, anything else we need to cover on this public hearing? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Colleagues, I had a little snippet of news to share with you, as long as we've got a moment or two. You know, sometimes we go through these exercises and we ask questions, and sometimes we get into what I refer to as pulling at loose threads. And sometimes those threads are more productive than others. But those of you that were serving on the committee last year know that that we pulled on a couple of threads within ODOT on the motor carrier division. And we had discovered that while individuals who pay their income taxes with a credit card or charged a convenience fee to do so, that motor carriers who were using a credit card were not being charged the same fee, and that was being treated by ODOT as a cost of doing business. The largest single transaction that anybody put a credit card down on in this process? $1.9 million. Yeah, my wife said that she'd be happy to marry him on the spot. Anybody had a credit limit like that. In any event, after those conversations, after pulling at that loose thread a little bit, ODOT decided to change their process and apply the same standards to motor carriers that we do to private individuals. Now, what does that mean? That means that in 2016, the fiscal year, that the division paid out $2.58 million in transaction costs to the bank for the privilege of using credit cards. This year, we didn't pay out any of that. In fact, we received in $54,000 in people that decided to pay the transaction fees. Fewer people using cards. Those that are using them are paying a convenience fee to do so. So we went from $2.58 million out to $54,000 in. It's interesting to me that over a 10-year period, merchant fees paid out previously came to $15 million. It's a loose thread that that this committee pursued, and it paid off. So keep asking questions as we meet with these various agencies. Yes, Senator.
For those of you that are new, the co-chair has been very gracious and has included the committee in this. It was his leadership and his tenacity and his stick-to-itiveness that has got these results. I mean, I appreciate you wanting to share the committee, but it would not have happened without your leadership, Mr.
Well,
Chairman.
That's very, very kind, Senator, but you all put up with my persistent probing. All right.
Job well done.
All right. So most of the members of the full committee will be traveling east tomorrow and doing an open hearing in Madras.
Mm-hmm. No.
And then Hermiston.
Hermiston
first, and then Madras.
And then Madras.
And we will be reconvening here on Monday. So I want to thank all of you, and we are adjourned.